So we're looking together this evening at James chapter 1, verses 2 to 12. And this passage begins and ends talking about steadfastness. We could equally translate that Greek word perseverance or endurance, keeping going as a Christian. That's what it means when this word occurs in the New Testament, keeping going as a Christian. The book of James, of course, is next door to the book of Hebrews. And Hebrews talks a lot about this. But I think James is addressing a bit of a different problem. In Hebrews, the readers are flirting with outright apostasy. That is, consciously abandoning Christianity, exchanging it for a different religion, a different way of salvation, that of animal sacrifices and priestly ritual, which in reality, of course, offers no salvation at all. And that's the backdrop then to the writer urging his readers to keep going as Christians, the danger of apostasy. In James, however, abandoning Christian faith in that brazen way doesn't seem to be the issue. Rather, it's a deficient view of Christian faith. That's the issue, a deficient view of Christian faith whereby you can intellectually believe the gospel, believe with your mind that Jesus is the Son of God who died for our sins, and you can then live the rest of your life without that faith making any real difference. And you're okay, you're a believer because you have said yes to a few gospel propositions. There seems to be that deficient view of Christian faith among James's readers, and the place where he deals with it most directly is the second half of chapter 2. But it's also in the background as he talks about steadfastness. He's saying authentic Christianity isn't about a one-off moment of conversion, a one-off moment of assenting to a certain set of truths. No, it's about years and years, perhaps decades and decades, of subsequently keeping going as a Christian. That's what authentic Christianity is about. So that hopefully gives you some insight into James's thinking as he begins this letter on this theme of endurance, steadfastness. And as we study these verses then, I want us to notice three things that steadfastness is not. I know that sounds a rather negative way for us to proceed, but I just have found it the most helpful way of tracing James's logic here. And so let's look at these three things in turn. First of all, steadfastness is not instantly present. Steadfastness is not instantly present. So you decide one day that you're going to take up running. And of course, running isn't like judo or pole vaulting or something. There's no particular skill or technique that you have to carefully learn. And so what do you do then on that day that you decide you're going to take up running? Well, of course, you go online and you search for the next marathon that's coming up in your area and you sign up for it. No, you don't. That's not what you do. And the reason that's not what you do is this: while yes, it's true that running technique is marvelously uncomplicated, it's pretty much instantly present as soon as you take up running, while that's true, the fact is that running a marathon requires more. It requires endurance, steadfastness, the ability to keep going mile after mile after mile after mile. And that steadfastness is not instantly present the day you take up running. You have very little of it actually at that point. And that's why then, if you have an ounce of common sense, you don't sign up for that marathon. You need to acquire this quality of steadfastness. And this steadfastness that James is talking about, this ability to keep going as a Christian year after year after year, that's so important, that ultimately marks someone out as having genuine faith, this steadfastness is the same. It too is not instantly present. The believer doesn't possess it on day one of the Christian life, having just been born again. Like the runner's steadfastness, it has to be acquired. And how does that happen? Well, let's stick with the analogy. How does that running novice acquire steadfastness? Is it a case of going along to a sports shop and splashing out on the most expensive, sophisticated running gear, the bounciest trainers, the most lightweight, sweat-absorbent vest? Does all that stuff do the trick? Is there a guarantee inside that shoebox that these trainers you've just bought will definitely enable you to complete the marathon, or you'll get your money back the next day? No. Fancy gear hardly helps at all. The way that runner acquires steadfastness, in a nutshell, is this: through pressure and pain. The pressure and pain of running day in, day out, running up steep hills, running through muddy fields, running into strong winds, running along sandy beaches, running when it's pouring with rain, running when the cold makes your fingers numb, running when you've got a stitch, running when the sweat is stinging your eyes, running when blisters are making you wince, running when you've tripped and blood is gushing down your leg, running when your mind is starting to play tricks, running when your heart feels close to exploding, running when another step feels like a Herculean effort. As the runner does that, then gradually, through the pressure and the pain, steadfastness develops. And how does the Christian novice acquire steadfastness? Well, James says it's in the same way, through pressure and pain. Verse 3, the testing of your faith produces steadfastness. And if you're in any doubt what he means by that phrase, the testing of your faith, he has used a synonym in the previous verse, trials. That's what he's talking about, i.e. pressure and pain. That, he says, is what forms over time this steadfastness, this ability to keep going in the life of the believer. And at this point in the sermon, then, I just want to make sure that we understand that. James can say to these readers, you know, verse 3, you know that the testing of your faith produces steadfastness. Well, do we know? Does our theology of trials include this emphasis? By the way, we must be careful not to have too narrow a definition of trials. James refers to trials of various kinds. In other words, they come in all sorts of shapes and sizes. A trial doesn't have to be on a spectacularly catastrophic scale in order to qualify as a trial. It might just be a low key, nagging frustration or difficulty in someone's life. There's a whole spectrum of events and circumstances and situations which to some degree exert pressure and cause pain. And I'm saying we mustn't have, therefore, too narrow a definition of what a trial is. But I'm asking, does our theology of trials include the emphasis of James chapter 1 verse 3? Because of course there's more that can be said about trials than that. The Bible has more to say about them. The emphasis of Romans 8 verses 18 to 21, for instance, is that trials, or the sufferings of the present time as Paul calls them, are a sad manifestation of a creation that's been subjected to frustration, is in bondage to decay. And that's a vitally important emphasis that should definitely be there in our theology, that trials are bad. Trials aren't natural to God's universe. They flow from the curse which God had to impose on account of man's rebellion. Trials are a temporary intrusion into reality, which Paul says in that passage should provoke us to groan for the coming liberation of the universe when trials will be no more. So that emphasis is vitally important, but alongside that emphasis, we should also have this one, that the trials we face, while yes, at one level, the sad consequence of the curse, at another level, they provide the pain and pressure that we need for the development of endurance and steadfastness. Yes, trials are bad. That's Romans 8, 18 to 21. But in the lives of believers, God has this good use for them. John Newton eloquently captures this two-sided perspective of trials in a poem that he once wrote. In the poem, he ponders the reality that even life's best situations and experiences are never cloudless. There's always stress and pain tempering the satisfaction and joy. He asks, why are thus our hopes beguiled? Why are all our pleasures spoiled? Why do agony and woe from our choicest comforts grow? And he answers, sin has been the cause of all. 'Twas not thus before the fall. What but pain and thorn and sting from the root of sin can spring? Now with every good we find vanity and grief entwined. What we feel or what we fear, all our joys embitter here. But then, having given that answer, that our trials flow from the fall, he in the next verse qualifies it in this way. He says, yet through the Redeemer's love, these afflictions blessings prove. He the wounding stings and thorns into healing medicines turns. Is that part of our thinking? Trials as healing medicines, or more precisely in terms of James 1, as the means by which we become endurance athletes, believers with the steadfastness to keep going and keep going throughout the marathon of the Christian life. And so that's the first thing to note in our passage. Steadfastness is not instantly present. But then notice with me, secondly, steadfastness is not intuitively prized. Steadfastness is not intuitively prized. So just considered in and of itself, I don't think steadfastness is a quality which, as Christians, we intuitively prize. Because it's not glamorous. In terms of this morning's sermon, pulling out a sword and waving it around in a dramatic show of devotion to Jesus, that's glamorous. That has a certain impressiveness about it. Being consistently loyal to Jesus year after year after year, keeping going over a long period of time, that's not particularly glamorous. I mean, if we were just given the second half of verse 4 here, dot, 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 that you may be perfect and complete, lacking in nothing. And we were asked to suggest a first half for that verse, I wonder what we would come up with. What kind of person do we picture when we hear those words, perfect and complete, lacking in nothing. Perhaps the kind of person who writes Christian books and speaks at Christian conferences and starts up Christian organizations and just seems to have a finger in so many pies and be involved in so many ministries and achieve so much. That's the kind of Christian we picture. So that when James says, no, it's the steadfast person, it's the persevering person, the plodding, persevering person. It's the person that keeps going. It's that person who is perfect and complete, lacking in nothing. We kind of scratch our heads. James, are you sure about that? You really mean that? Just considered in and of itself, I'm saying, steadfastness is not a quality which we intuitively prize. And then, when you throw in what we were saying a moment ago, that pressure and pain are the root to steadfastness, that of course diminishes our enthusiasm even further. Nothing is more counterintuitive than to think in the middle of a trial, this is producing steadfastness in me. And in James's language in verse 2, counting it, therefore, a joy. A joy. Actually, it's interesting, in the realm of running, we might think like that. Some of you are runners or have been runners, and you've had the experience then on a really hard run, or perhaps in a different scenario, the experience of being in a cafe with a bunch of friends and they're ordering delicious tray bakes, but you won't let yourself do that. You've had that those kinds of experiences, and you've managed in those experiences, you've managed an inward smile or an inward fist pump at the thought, this exhaustion I'm feeling on this run or this cake I'm foregoing in the cafe, it might be painful now, but on mile 22 of that marathon in a few weeks' time, then it will count for something. Then I'll have more endurance than I would otherwise have done. In the realm of running, we might just about succeed, I think, in thinking that way. It seems way harder, however, in the realm of the Christian life to think like that. In the face of trials, to think like that. Now, to a degree, that's understandable because the analogy between the runner's painful training regime and the Christian's painful trials is not a perfect analogy. The runner chooses to subject his or her body to those daily grueling sessions. The Christian's trials, on the other hand, just come entirely unsolicited. Then again, the runner is in control of how long the session lasts and when it stops and when the pain and pressure ends. The Christian, on the other hand, may have very little control indeed over his or her trials. So there are those differences, but whatever all the reasons are, I'm saying it's a hard and a counterintuitive thing for the Christian in the face of a trial to think positively, this is producing steadfastness in me. And that's why in verses 5 to 8, James talks about wisdom. Because if the believer is going to prize steadfastness, if the believer is going to prize this quality which is produced through trials, through pain and pressure, then he or she is going to need wisdom. That is God-given wisdom. And how does the believer get that wisdom from God? Well, James's answer is stunningly simple: by asking for it. If any of you lacks wisdom, verse 5, that is the wisdom to be able to think in the middle of a trial, this is producing steadfastness in me. If any of you lacks wisdom, let him ask God. Let him ask God. Now, James goes on to say in verses 6 to 8 that this asking must be sincere. Verse 6 is a verse that is often taken out of context and misapplied, I think, with quite damaging effects. For one thing, it's applied to all prayer in general rather than the specific request for wisdom in the face of trials, which is what James is talking about. And then secondly, it's assumed usually that the doubt James is talking about is a very psychological thing. It's fear, it's misgivings, it's lack of confident expectation. But notice James himself defines the doubt that he has in mind. This doubt, he says in verse 8, is being double-minded. Now that's a word which James himself coins. It's not been found in any Greek literature prior to James writing. And perhaps the closest English adjective that we can come up with is duplicitous. In other words, James isn't talking about fear and misgivings and lack of confident expectation. I mean, we all struggle with that, and we all experience it in much of our prayer, no doubt, which is why often we come away from James 1:6 feeling so terribly guilty. But as I say, that's not what James is talking about. He's talking about something much more deliberate and perverse. He's talking about out and out insincerity, asking for divine wisdom in the face of a trial when you have no real intention of responding wisely, no real desire to respond wisely to it, because you've already committed yourself to a very, very different kind of response. Let me illustrate. You're experiencing then hostility from someone. Someone is mistreating you. Someone's been bad to you. And in the face of that trial then, in your morning prayer time, you very reverently, very eloquently ask God for wisdom to see this trial as one of John Newton's healing medicines. You ask for wisdom to regard this trial as a means by which your steadfastness can grow. And you ask God for that wisdom then, in that morning prayer time, while at the same time having every intention of later on in the day going round to that person who is making life hard for you and doing something to them and getting even with them and pursuing revenge and settling the score. In other words, you don't really want wisdom to respond in a wise way. It's just that you want to play the role of a good Christian in your morning prayer time. You just want to say the pious thing. But there's this other course of action that you've already committed yourself to, which is quite at odds with your request for God's wisdom. Or the trial is unemployment. You're out of work. Painful trial. And again, in prayer to God, in the morning, you ask him for wisdom to regard this trial in the way set out in our passage, to regard it as a means of endurance strengthening. While at the same time, you have an appointment with a friend at Starbucks that afternoon, where you fully intend to bombard her with all your woes and how unfair everything is and how everything's against you and God is being hard on you and all the rest of it. You don't really want wisdom. It's just the pious thing to say in prayer. You just want to play the part, play the role. That's what James is talking about here. Not some psychological doubts. He's talking about cynical insincerity. asking for wisdom when you're plotting a very unwise kind of course, quite intentionally, quite deliberately, quite consciously. That's why he talks about this wave of the sea in verse 6. This person is like a wave of the sea that is driven and tossed by the wind. He's talking about the swell, not a wave crashing on the shore so much as the sea out in the ocean when it's windy. And the wave is just constantly changing shape. You can't pin it down. One moment it looks like this, the next moment it looks like something else. And James is saying this person is like that. In prayer time, they sound so pious. It seems like they want wisdom. But in their actual behavior, the rest of the day, something completely different. And so James is saying then that this request for wisdom, it must be sincere. But he's saying if it is, then God will give you that wisdom. If you really want wisdom to regard the trial you're facing properly, then God will give you that wisdom. No doubt, no question, he says. He'll give you it without reproach, verse 5, a lovely phrase. In other words, he won't rebuke you for asking. You know, it's like when you apply for a job and they interview you and then they turn you down and they say, well, you don't have enough experience. And you say, well, that's why I'm applying for the job, so I can get some experience. And it's not like that with God then, that we go to him asking for wisdom and God says, well, why haven't you got any wisdom? That's why we're going to God. And God then doesn't reproach us. He doesn't rebuke us for lacking the thing we're asking him for. He gives, he gives, he gives. And so tonight, if you're struggling with some trial, some adversity, some difficulty in the Christian life, and you want that to be a means of you becoming a stronger Christian, becoming more steadfast, go to God and he will give you the wisdom you need to respond to that trial properly. So steadfastness then, it isn't instantly present. It isn't intuitively prized. But then thirdly, steadfastness isn't inherently precious. Steadfastness isn't inherently precious. So it is precious, and that's what we've been talking about this evening. It is precious, but it isn't inherently precious, by which I mean steadfastness is not an end in itself. Steadfastness is not an end in itself. To go back to the analogy, the runner wants to be steadfast. The runner wants to be able to endure the 26 miles of the marathon, but it's precisely that. He or she wants to be steadfast so that he or she will get to the finish line. It's the finishing line that's the end. Steadfastness is only the means to that end. That's the big thing. That's what it's all about. It's crossing the finishing line. It's getting to the end of the race. Steadfastness is not inherently precious. It's precious as a means to getting to the finish line. And it's the same then in the Christian life. And that's what James brings out in verse 12. Blessed is the man who remains steadfast under trial, for when he has stood the test, he will receive the crown of life which God has promised to those who love him. That's the great thing about steadfastness, that it enables you to make it to the end and receive the crown of life. It's a lovely phrase, that, isn't it? Of course, as believers, we have life now, don't we? From the moment of regeneration, we have life. We have been raised with Christ, Paul says in Ephesians and in Colossians. We are alive. But I suppose the point of a crown is that it makes something public. It exhibits something, doesn't it? So the queen is queen whether she wears a crown or not. She's as much queen when she's in a Land Rover on the Balmoral estate, in wellies and old clothes, as she is when she's at some great royal occasion in her robes and her crown. But the crown makes it obvious, makes it public that she's queen. She doesn't look like queen when she's at Balmoral in the old clothes and the Land Rover, but she looks like queen when she's in the crown. And that's the point then, that yes, as Christians we have life now, but it's hidden, isn't it? We don't turn heads in the street because we're alive in Jesus Christ. People don't walk past and say, wow, what's happened to you? We don't shine. There's nothing that stands out about us outwardly, visibly. But on that day there will be. We're going to be raised. And angels and men will see that we are alive. It will be obvious in our very outward appearance on Resurrection Day. And that's the crowning then. That's the making visible of something which is already true. And James is saying then that the great thing about steadfastness is that it sees you through to indeed receive that crown of life. And this is an important point then, because in the face of trials then, the wise believer doesn't just say, this trial is producing steadfastness in me. He or she goes further than that. This trial is producing steadfastness in me, which will ensure I make the finishing line and receive the crown of life. And that attitude is kind of expressed for us, isn't it, in verse 9, where James says, let the lowly believe. So this is the trial beset believer. Remember we said last week, these Christians to whom he's writing, they were lowly. They were exiles from Jerusalem. They're refugees now. They're having to make their home in a place where they don't really belong. And they would have been at the very bottom, therefore, of the social ladder, most of them. They were lowly. That was the form that their trial was taking. They were social outcasts. They were lowly within society. And James is saying then, let that lowly Christian boast in his exaltation. That is, in the crowning that is coming. Let him persevere. Not because perseverance is in itself a great thing, but persevere, boasting in the crowning, the coronation that's coming. By the way, James shows in that paragraph, verses 9 to 11, what a great pastor he is. Because he recognizes that although most of his readers are in a certain situation, they are lowly, they are trial beset, they aren't all. He's conscious that some of his readers, for whatever reason, seem to be more prosperous. He'll talk later on, won't he, about some of them being merchants who go off, travel from city to city, businessmen and women. So some of them are more successful, and he touches on that, I think, in verses 10 and 11. You see, yes, for most of his readers, their situation is one of lowliness, and the danger then is that they just sink into despair. But he's saying, no, let those believers boast in their coming coronation. But there may be one or two of you, he says, who actually are doing very well materially and economically. And the danger for you is that you think you've got everything now, and you need your bubble burst a bit, perhaps. You should think of your humiliation, that you're still mortal, you're going to die soon, and you might die in the very midst of flourishing, in fact. And you see, what I mean about James here and his brilliance as a preacher, as a pastor here, because you see, both these things are true of all believers, aren't they? All believers are, on the one hand, heading for coronation. They are princes and heirs. On the other hand, they are mortal and they're going to die soon. But Not all believers need the same one of those truths applied to them at a particular time. Most of his readers needed the former truth applied to them because they were lowly and they needed to think of coming coronation. But some of his readers were prosperous and needed to remember and bear in mind their mortality, and that however prosperous they were, it wouldn't shield them from death. But the main point here then is that in trials, boasting in that coming day, not pursuing steadfastness for its own sake, but pursuing steadfastness because steadfastness leads to crowning. And so this evening then, may we learn these lessons. At the most basic level, may we know, as James says his readers know, may we know intellectually in our heads, may we know that trials, pressure and pain is the route through which steadfastness is developed. But more than just knowing that, may we be given from God the wisdom in our actual trials to see those trials as steadfastness producing, endurance producing. And may we want to be endurers because we see beyond this life to that day when Christ will raise us from our graves and crown us with resurrection life. May God bless his word to us. Amen.